Good evening. My name is Nancy Smith, and I am an alcoholic. Happy Easter to anybody who celebrates that. I did my best to be an Easter egg. Since nobody can afford to actually decorate eggs anymore, we can decorate ourselves. I even changed my watch band. I want to thank Mark for inviting me, and I understand it is a part of the covenant that we tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, but more importantly, end at 7:15. So I will endeavor my best to do that. Before the meeting, we were having a little nostalgic discussion about, oh, remember Radford, remember this, remember that, and I don't know if any of you remember Byron Wallin, but when he shared, he always used to include this, and so as a tribute to him, I would like to start off with this reading. My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think I am following your will doesn't mean that I'm actually doing so, but I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope that I have that desire in all that I am doing. And don't touch your screen. But I believe that that desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope that I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, although I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. We have to believe, I think, that this is something that God would have us do. And here we are on a holiday where some people would be spending it in different ways. And what we're doing is not drinking and going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the same 24 hours that we repeat over and over again. I'm supposed to, like I said, tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. And if you're an alcoholic with any gumption at all, you're good at judging people. And so I always like to start off with that I'm a lesbian, a lawyer, and a Libra. And if that's all you hear, you can just sit there and judge me and think about other things while we have a meeting, And my sobriety date is December 31st of 1984. It was not a New Year's resolution. It was the end, I just could not do it anymore. And I grew up in at a poolside cocktail party in a place called Hidden Hills. And before other people knew what Hidden Hills, like now it's some fancy place. It was, fairly fancy, but nothing like it is now. But my parents were grand party hosts. And the way it looked to me was that long before it was fashionable, both of my parents had a job. And the reason that they had a job, my mother worked so that they could party the way they wanted. And that meant they could invite people over, and they could invite people over on Friday night, and they would leave on Sunday, and they may or may not leave their impression in the screen door because they were too drunk to open it when they went through it. They would pull babies out of the pool and say, "Oh, is that one yours?" And don't let it drown. And so they had a great time. My father was a Limerick guy, and he would entertain people. And they had friends who were in the entertainment business, not because my parents knew anything about the entertainment business, but because they had steady jobs and they had a bar, and so people who were in the entertainment business who didn't have steady jobs would come and partake and have a great time and entertain us, right? And so it was party on. And You know, I came from this family where children were given sips of alcohol as soon as they became able to cruise the room. You know, when they could get up and walk from one from the sofa to the chair, somebody would give them a little sip, and then we would they would pass out in the middle of the room, and everybody would continue to party. And I'm sure that that happened with me. My mother used to say that her contribution to my health was that she drank sitting on the floor so she didn't fall down when she was pregnant with me. And, she started drinking during Prohibition. You know, it's like the entire country is supposed to be dry, and that's when she starts drinking. So this is my heritage. This is, my birthright. And I drank whenever I had an opportunity, but I really kind of kicked it off in high school. By that time, my mother was just, both of my parents drank a lot, but, my mother, well, she died primarily of cirrhosis of the liver, so, you can kind of get the idea. And so she was a gin drinker, and I had a 14-ounce Lavoris bottle that I would, in high school, that I would steal. I would fill it up like 2 ounces at a time, and she never noticed, so that I had 14 ounces of gin to go to whatever high school event there was on the weekend. And that's when I started doing that in earnest. Because she was a drunk, she got me a car before I had a driver's license. And that's where I would hide my booze, is in the back of that. It was a 55 T-Bird. I knew exactly where that Lavoris bottle would stick in the back not to break. And I was protecting that right to drink from a very early age. And so, my MO was to drink as often as I could. In high school, it's not, it's like on weekends, and then I get into college and it's more often. And my plan for life was something like this. How much can you drink and still achieve outside stuff? You know, can you get decent grades? Can you stay out of trouble? Can you not be arrested? Can you do these things? You know, where is that balance? And I'm like 16 years old, and this is my plan for life, right? And I get into college, and, of course, I have multiple incidents of, craziness when I'm drinking, but the gist of it is that I want to drink as much as I can and still keep the heat off. Heat wasn't always off, but, that's the obsession that I had. And so I carried that through college. I managed to graduate. I always wanted to be Lois Lane, and I got a journalism degree, and I started working as, if anybody knows what this is anymore, a newspaper reporter. Right? Do we even have those anymore? And so I became Lois Lane, and that's what I wanted to do. And one of the attractions to that is it seemed to me that it was a hard-drinking profession. And then I left that, and I went to law school. And I kind of determined that a profession is a hard-drinking profession if I am in it. Because I'm the one that is setting the standard. And I started becoming a daily drinker as soon as I could afford it. Basically, that was my job. My mother worked so that she could drink, worked so that they could entertain people, and that's what I thought being a grown-up was. And so I went to college, I got a job, as soon as I got a paycheck, I was drinking every night. And one of my favorite things about that first job as a newspaper reporter was a place called The Keg. And this was in Santa Monica. I was working for the Santa Monica Evening Outlook. And we put out 3 editions a day, And we'd start at, you know, like the 7:30 edition, and we would, you know, I'd get in there and crank myself full of caffeine, type on a manual typewriter, throw the carriage back, and just think I am all that, and the teletype is going. And then at 3 o'clock, we'd go over across the alley to the keg. And I'm 21 years old, and the bartender is seeing me come down the hall, and I don't know if you had places like this, but it's one of those, when you come in, you have to come in off the alley because all the cool kids come in off the alley. And that makes you walk by the men's room before you get there. And so you walk down this hall, and there's this fantastic aroma of urine and beer. And you think, I have arrived. And I walk up there to the, you know, to the bar, and they're putting the pitcher. Never ordered anything but a pitcher. They put the pitcher up there, and I was doing that every night. And I'm just barely legal to drink. And I thought I had arrived. So I thought I was all that, and I was too good for them. So I went to law school, and I used higher education to control and enjoy my drinking for a little bit, which meant that I didn't drink for, I don't know, the first few months of law school. I went to a two-year program because don't you know that takes you 3 years, but I'm smarter, I can do it in two. And so I go to this two-year program, and by the time I'm done, I'm drinking every night. I go to take the bar exam, and the long and short of it is that I flunk the bar exam because I can't stay sober for the 3 days it takes to take that test. It doesn't matter that I've spent thousands of dollars in tuition. It doesn't matter that I have worked my tail off to get to this place, and I'm at the test, and I write a contract question as a tort or a tort as a contract. I don't know what it was. I wrote it wrong, and I failed. And it was the first time I had ever failed. And if you're anything like me, you know, that's a really good excuse to drink. You know, so I drank for a while after that, studied again. And, you know, actually one of my favorite tales is that when I took the test the next time, I ran into a guy. I was just going to, like, put my nose to the grindstone. You had those times, you know, 3 days. I can do this. I cannot drink for 3 days. You know, at that time, I'm like, I don't know, 30 years old, and I'm going to get this done. And I go to this patio where I've made my lunch so that I don't have to see anybody. And I go to a patio all by myself, and some guy comes up and sits next to me. And in 5 minutes, we're talking about hangover cures. You know, it's like we can smell each other. You know? How did he even know I was there? We finish the test. I go home with him, or he goes home with me. I don't know which one. And we drink for a matter of days or weeks, and we don't even know, because we're celebrating that we've taken this test. Ultimately, I did pass the test, and I became an attorney. And I practiced for, like, I don't know, 20 years, something like that. But I had this, I don't know, it's like God's joke. I don't know about your God, but, you know, God, as I understand God, has a sense of humor. And he said, Nancy, you think you're pretty smart. I'm going to give you everything you think is going to make you feel okay. See what happens. So I had a great job at a boutique law firm doing interesting, sophisticated litigation, which is what I wanted to do. At that time, I was married to a man who was a partner in a downtown Los Angeles law firm. We were both making more money than I had ever conceived of being possible, and I barely made enough money to pay the taxes on the money that he made. I had a brand new Nissan Z car. We lived in a very nice neighborhood in the west side of Los Angeles, and my life was falling out my sleeve. And I couldn't stop drinking. I drank every day. And when you drink every day, you don't, like, mess things up every day. You just mess things up when it's important, right? And so it eluded me that that common denominator of the bad times related to drinking. And I have to tell you that a lot of it had to do with what I considered a fidelity flaw that I had. It didn't really matter who I always had a primary relationship, often being married, and at that time it was to a man, and so I always had this primary relationship. But I felt as if you never really know if that's going to work out, right? Oh, I know we said, like, sickness and in health and all. Did we really mean that, you know, till death do us part? That's like a little heavy. And so I'd always like to have sort of this backup relationship. And so that involved a lot of sneaking around and, you know, and then I had places where I went with certain guys, you know, not with others. And then actually there was this restaurant one time where I went and I didn't think anybody knew who I was. And I walked in and just like that bartender had put the beer on the bar for me, this guy at this fancy Chinese restaurant looked at me coming in and said, and got my drink ready for me at the table as I sat down. And I thought, oh, well, actually, what I thought is I need to go someplace else, you know. But, you know, I was there with different people at different times. And, you know, basically I was unable to fulfill my promise of being faithful. So on December 31st of 1984, you know, one more time, I end up drunk in a motel room with somebody that I shouldn't be with. And I thought, oh my goodness, I should probably call my husband, you know. That's a nice call, like from the hotel room, you know, shh, right? And he was kind of fed up with me and said, oh, well, you know, your alma mater, which is USC, is playing in the Rose Bowl, and I got some tickets for tomorrow, but you need to find somebody to go with because it's not going to be me. And so I went home that night, and it was just like one more. It was the time for me to hear it. So I went to this priest because, you know, they have some magic, right? They got some special juju. And I said, I tell the priest my situation, and I'm thinking that he's like focused on my infidelity. And he says to me, do you think you have a problem with drinking? And it's like, whoa, where did that come from? Of course, I had never cheated when I was sober, but I hadn't been sober, so, you know, how does that conclusion ever come about, right? And I had one of those moments that you hear talked about in alcoholics all the time, this moment of clarity. He asked me a question. So there's the question mark, and there seems like this eternity between then and my ability to answer that question. And I reached down in my soul and I said yes. I didn't say anything else. I was able to somehow say yes. And I'm thinking, oh, I cop to this with him, and he's gonna give me 5 Hail Marys and a couple of acts of kindness, and it's all gonna be okay. And he says, I know somebody who said if I ever meet someone who has a problem with alcohol, that I should refer them to her. And that was Sister Sheila. And Sister Sheila was a member in good standing of the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in the West Los Angeles area. She was the principal of St. Augustine's elementary school. And I was shocked. And she said, I called her on the phone, And I was somehow able to not drink between the time I was with that priest until the time I connected with Sister Sheila. And she said, can you come to the convent? Of course, it's like, you know, 5 minutes from my house. And so I get there, and I think she's going to embrace me and heal me and pray for me. And she says, do you have a car? Yes. Do you have a driver's license? Yes. Do you have insurance? Yes. Get in the car. She tells me to get in the car, and I went with her, and Sister Mary was with her. And I don't know if you ever traveled around with nuns, but the first thing they do is pray. They get in your car and they pray, like, oh, okay, that's fine. I probably needed that. And we drive to Ohio Street in West LA. And I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have some designer jeans which have pockets in the front, which are really good for just like sticking your hands deep in your pocket. And then, you know, eye contact when you're new, I'm not that high priority, right? So I'm walking around, my hands in my pockets, looking down, and everybody comes up to me and they say, are you new? How did they know? Right. Of course, I figure out later, they all know each other, and I'm the new face in the room, right? And so people, you know, what I did is I started doing the things that they did. Sister Sheila became my first sponsor, and you know, we started doing what Dee said, great recommendation, work the steps, you know, they're in order, they're numbered for a reason. And so what I started to do was really kind of the same things that I do now. You know, like I got a sponsor. I went to the same meetings all the time. At that time, there were, I went to 6 meetings a week, and on the 7th night, there was laundry. And at that time, the meeting started like at 8:30, and they were an hour and a half. And so I would work. I was working 12 hours a day as an attorney, and I would leave there, and I would go through. I became a fast food connoisseur because that was what dinner. You know, I would leave the office, and I would go through the fast food, eat in the car, show up at the meeting, and do whatever commitment I had been assigned to do. And, you know, those commitments varied over the years and a lot of times, but I recommend that you get a sponsor, you get a home group, and go to the same meetings. This would be my suggestion. This is what I did. The same meetings all the time. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is that if you see the same people over and over again, somebody might just notice if you're not there. And here's the shocker, you might notice and care if somebody else isn't there, because we become a family. And so I spent the first, I don't know, is it 20, 25 years of my sobriety in the Pacific group, getting in lockstep with all of the people that were there, doing the things that they did. And it just looks like this, you know, you find somebody that has what you want. And then you ask them how they got that. And any alcoholic worth their salt will tell you in detail, right? And how did you get to where you are? And then you do what they did. And then you do it over again. You just keep doing that. And we find that there's nothing that we have to go through alone. I was having a conversation before the meeting with a couple of people about having, you know, being a cancer survivor. In 2009, I was diagnosed with 3 different kinds of cancer. I thought, you've got to be kidding. You know, like one isn't enough. And so I got breast cancer and anal cancer and skin cancer. And, you know, 2009 just sucked. And I spent a lot of time in radiation and in chemo, and then a year after that in some other kind of infusion therapy and surgeries. And I was saying that, you know, there's really nothing better than going in to have your asshole radiated, you know. oh yeah, I can't wait. And then they told me I had to do it for like, you know, another 6 weeks or something. And I just thought, you got to be kidding me. I don't think I can do this. And then I did exactly what we were talking about. I treated my oncologist like my sponsor. Because, you know, your sponsor's going to ask you to do things and you're going to say, I can't do that. You know, and you're going to do it anyway. When you do it anyway, then you get this beautiful life. And so one of the things that I was talking to Mark about during the break is, you know, I have, in 2009, when I had that, I decided that I was going to live, I was going to act as if I was going to live. Now, I didn't know whether I would or not, but, you know, what the hell, right? And if I've survived alcoholism by getting a sponsor, going to meetings, doing the thing, working the steps, taking a commitment, doing all those things, then I'm just going to live my life one day at a time like I was taught. And so one of the things that I had always wanted to do from the time I was a little kid is I wanted to have an Australian Shepherd. When I was a kid, I watched them herd in the neighborhood that I grew up in, and I asked the shepherd, how did they learn to do that? And he said, they learned it from their mama. And I thought, that's one smart dog. I want to have one of those. And so I'm about to die, and I think, what the hell? I'm going to get a dog. So what I did is I started training my dogs is in agility, and I compete in that on a regular basis. This last year, I had a knee replacement. I had a recurring sinus infection for probably 9 months out of the year, which, thank God, both of them are, you know, healed. But it's like I get to do this. I get to get up, and every day that I am healthy enough, I train my dogs. Every day that I am healthy enough, I work in my garden. Every day that I am healthy enough, I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I talk to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have the privilege of taking calls from Dee, who is a magnificent example of this program, a good member of this group. And there are so many times that she gives me purpose to be in the place and time when she's going to call. You know, that's not me on the Natch, right? People aren't calling me. And I'm not very outgoing. I can be gregarious in a group, but, you know, the truth of the matter is I have a lot of friends in agility, and I get active in that. But there is nothing like it being 7:30 on a Monday or Thursday, and I know she's going to call at 7:35. That is like the biggest honor. And I can tell you, when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, it never really occurred to me that I wanted to connect with people. You know, it was not on my goal. You know, my goal is, I don't want to feel this bad anymore. I am tired of it. I am ashamed of my behavior. I feel as if I can't control myself. And when I came in here and I said, you know, I got that my problem was alcohol, that I was drinking every day and driving my soul into the ground. And I came here and it said, my primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. I don't know about you, but I've been looking for my primary purpose for a very long time. Of course, I thought it was like to be president of the United States or, you know, something famous, maybe rich, you know, that would be good. Some other things. I didn't think that this would be my primary purpose, but here I am. And so I get to live this big, full life. I had an opportunity to go to Costa Rica and go whitewater rafting about 30 years ago, I guess now. And there in the rainforest, I fell in love with this woman. And I thought, isn't that interesting? And so she was living in Texas. So we, and at that time, I don't know if you 30 years ago, like we had these, you know, cell phones that were $1 an hour or something like that, you know? And, you know, when you're newly enamored, you spend a lot of time on the phone, right? Especially if there's long distance. And she moved out here, and we've been together ever since. And we have this this really lovely life that is, in a lot of ways, very boring, you know? I have things that I do each day of the week. She has things that she does each day of the week. And, you know, and frankly, the only reason that I don't come to these meetings more often is that by 8 o'clock, I'm usually in bed nowadays. You know, I feel grateful that I can be 74 years old. You know, but I have no illusions about that. And so, you know, going to bed early is a part of the new routine, and trying to take care of myself after I recovered from that infection is a part of it, and, you know, working my knee out and doing all that stuff. And sometimes I talk to my sponsor, who's, you know, several years older than I am, and I find that we're just really talking about, like, what was your medical appointment like? When I was a kid, I remember my grandmother doing that and thinking, oh, my God, that is so lame. And I have become her. Is that the progressive ad? You know, don't become your parents. Anyway, so I have this great life. And each day I start off, it's not that I haven't failed to do this, but, you know, each day I start with that prayer that I read to you, that reading that I read to start with. And a set of prayers and the daily reflections. And then I like to go to the morning Grange meeting and start my day with a little bit of meditation, a little quiet, and some sharing. And you know, it's pretty simple. Here's like the thing that I like the most, I think, is when I wake up in the morning now, it's like, oh, do I need to take a Tylenol? Because my old body doesn't want to get up. It used to be, do I need to apologize to anybody? Do I need to walk around the car to see if I hit anything or anybody? Like, I walk around the car, is there any blood? How did I get in bed last night? How did I get home? I know I'm in the right place, but I don't know how I got here. And my first thought was of shame and embarrassment and the quandary of how am I going to make this right? And one day at a time, I don't have to wake up like that anymore. You know, I can wake up and be grateful that, in fact, I woke up. And be grateful that I have this life in, of all places, Palmdale, California. I would never, who'd have thunk it, you know? But, you know, we have 2.5 acres and the dogs run around all they want. And I have a whole slew of friends with dogs that, you know, we play all the time. And that's really, you know, I guess the truth of the matter is all I want to do is, you know, stay sober and play with my dogs, you know, and I get to do that. And as we were talking at the break, you know, the thing about these dogs, not these dogs, all dogs, right? Cats as well. I'm a big cat lover. We just got 2 little kittens on Friday. We got 2 little 9-week-old kittens that are, you know, like to die for. Cute orange tabbies. Anyway, these critters have the ability to not judge, to give us unconditional love in a way that is exemplary, so that no matter what we have done, no matter who we have insulted, no matter how many amends we had to make today, they're happy to see us. They love us. And we know that if they poop on the floor, we pick it up, and we still love them. You know, it's this, it's a way for me to live that life that Alcoholics Anonymous has tried to teach me. And it's an example in front of me every day. I've had an incredible journey here, and the High Desert Big Book Group has been a big part of that. Mark has always been the most gracious to me. When I thought, you know, oh, I'm not going to that meeting anymore, you know, he's going to think something, you know, like, where did that come from? And that's not who he is. He's always embraced me in a welcoming way. And he did that when I moved away to Tucson for 3 years and I came back and he just said, you know, come on back. And that's, you know, he's the example to me of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter what we do, we welcome people. We welcome them the first time. We welcome them if they leave and they come back. If you're new, if you've been around for a while, if you're a slipper, if you've come back, whatever your status is, if you're an alcoholic of our type, it is my sincere wish that you never have a drink again. God bless you all. Amen.